three unclean spirits like frogs. But the mighty earthquake having commenced in 1848, and the democracy which caused it having been repressed to a considerable extent, what agency remains, as revealed in the scriptures of truth, by which it is to be brought about the wonderful consummation we have been considering? The answer to this question is contained in the following words. I saw, says the apostle, three unclean spirits like frogs, out of the mouth of the dragon, and out of the mouth of the beast, and out of the mouth of the false prophet, for they are the spirits of demons working wonders, and they go forth to the kings of the earth and of the whole habitable, to assemble them to the war of that great day of God the Almighty. And he gathered them together into a place called in the Hebrew tongue Armageddon. In this passage, we have to consider the three unclean spirits like frogs, the three mouths out of which they proceed, the parties to whom they go forth, and the fruit of their mission. There are three spirits and three mouths, that is, one spirit proceeding out of each mouth. But as they are all three like frogs and unclean, though proceeding from three different mouths, they are in nature, origin, and tendency the same. They are called the spirits of demons, not because of their uncleanness or wickedness, but because the mouths from which they issue are the demons or chiefs of the dominions represented by the dragon, the beast, and the false prophet. Now, the throne of the dragon is Constantinople, that of the two-horned beast, Vienna, and that of the image of the beast, Rome. The thrones being in these cities, it follows that the demon of the dragon is the Sultan, the demon of the two-horned beast, the Emperor of Austria, and the demon of the image, the false prophet himself. It is worthy of observation here that the text says, out of the mouth of the false prophet, and not out of the mouth of the image of the beast. In the beginning of the chapter, while the first vial is supposed to be pouring out, the papal Jupiter is styled the beast's image. But in the 13th verse of the same chapter, that is Revelation 16, while the spirits are at work, he is termed the false prophet. And in verse 20 of chapter 19 also, where it speaks of his perdition. This change of style is by no means accidental. If the reader take a view of the papal dominion at the close of the 18th century, then view it as it is now, and compare the views together, he will doubtless come to the conclusion that the Pope is no longer the image of the imperial head of the beast. He has no dominion, really, for it is so far consumed that what remains is of little or no account. He has goodwill enough to make terrible examples of the Democrats who caused his flight from Rome, but he cannot carry it into effect, because the French will not permit him. He is a fugitive in exile, and though pressed to return to Rome, he is afraid to go. Again, a footnote, written in 1849. Pius IX fled from the revolution to Gita in November 1848 and returned to Rome in 1850. It was not until 1870 that the fall of the temporal power was perfected. Back to the text. He is then no longer imperial, and consequently has fallen from iconism and become a simple prophet. Protestant and papal scribes are in the habit of applying the epithet false prophet to Muhammad, and therefore do not perceive its applicability to the Roman bishop. But neither Muhammad nor his successors are termed the false prophet in the Apocalypse. The Arabian was false enough, doubtless, but he was a far more respectable character than any pope that has ever reigned, and were I to choose between the two superstitions, I would rather be a Muslim than a papist. It was the glory of Muhammad to destroy idolatry. It is the infamy of the popes to be the high priests of the Queen of Heaven. The Saracens were God's locusts taught to torment, and the Ottomans God's cavalry to slay with political death the Catholic image worshippers of the Asiatic third part of the Roman dragon. Muhammad was his star, and his successors the commanders of the faithful, the angel of the bottomless pit, whose name in the Hebrew tongue is Abaddon, but in the Greek tongue hath his name Apollyon. These names in English signify destroyer, which is indicative of the mission of those who marshal themselves under the standard of the Arabian. The epithet false prophet is singularly applicable to the Roman bishop. It is a part of his function to preach or prophesy, that is, to speak unto men to edification and exhortation and comfort. From him these blessings are supposed to flow to all his children. Aaron was given to Moses to be his prophet because he could speak well. As Aaron then was speaker, mouth or prophet to Moses, so the Pope is now the mouth or prophet or speaker of the papacy, and no more. He is virtually stripped of his dominion. He can prophesy, but his rule is a thing of name and not a fact. A false prophet is he, truthless as Satan, sporting himself with his own deceivings and thereby provoking a speedy fate, which is capture and destruction. But before he and the two-horned beast, before whom he is now working, perish in the European fiery lake, they are blowing into a flame, they must fulfil the mission to which they are appointed under this series of the sixth vial. The Sultan, the Pope and the Emperor are the demons of the crisis and the mouths or speakers of the systems to which they belong. Forth from them are to proceed such measures of policy as will produce a general war. These political measures are symbolized as unclean spirits. They are spirits or influences exerted through the policy of the three governments, and unclean because nothing clean can proceed out of such mouths. Rome, Vienna and Constantinople are so many centers of intrigue where proceeds the evil that is to ruin the beast. From these are to go forth to the kings of the earth and to the kings of the whole habitable the results of the intrigues which will stir up all their propensities to war. The kings of the earth are here distinguished from the kings of the habitable. The former are the kings of Germany and Russia, etc., while the latter are the kings of Roman Europe, such as of Belgium, France, Spain, Portugal, Sardinia, Naples and Greece. They are all to be involved in war by the unclean spirits of the three demons, whose policy will bring about results that will ruin themselves and astonish the world. But why are these three political influences likened to frogs? I say, says the Apostle, three unclean spirits, like frogs, come out of these mouths. The interpretation I conceive is this. The frogs are the heraldic symbol of a power, which at the prophetic crisis is to be the proximate cause of the several policies which characterize the demon mouths. That is to say, if this frog power had not struck out a new course of operation which deranged everything, there would have been no ground for the Sultan, the Emperor and the Pope to change their policy, and all things would have gone on as usual. The frogs, therefore, and the spirits stand related to each other as cause and effect, the demons being only the media through which the frog power brings about the fatalities of the two-horned beast and the false prophet, and at the same time brings upon the arena a power which is to overtop the horns, repress the frog power itself, and build up the image of Nebuchadnezzar, preparatory to its being shivered to pieces on the mountains of Israel. In other words, the scenery of the 13th and 14th verses of this chapter is a symbolic representation of the working of things unto the judgment, when they shall take away his dominion to consume and to destroy it to the end. Who they are to work, to whom the work of destruction is committed, is obvious from the 22nd verse, where it is written, judgment was given to the saints. That is, in the higher sense, who do their work coevally with the people of the saints, or saints of the holy city, assuming the ruler judgment under the whole heaven. Now, from the evidence I am about to adduce, I think I shall be able to convince the reader that the frogs are the symbol of the French democracy, the old enemy of the beasts and their image. The testimony to establish this is as follows, gleaned from Eliot's Hori Apocalyptici. 1. Mount Forson, in his Monuments of the French Monarchy, page 4, plate 6, gives a frog as one of the monuments of the French King Childeric, thus writing respecting it. Another medal representing a frog, which was also an Egyptian symbol. This was found in AD 1653 at Saint-Brice near Tournai, with other things belonging to Childeric. He reigned until AD 456, that is, before the Franks acknowledged the Roman bishop. And there's a picture of a medal of a frog found in the tomb of Kilderic I. Second point, in the monde primitif comparé avec le monde moderne par Monsieur Court de Gebelin, Paris 1781, the author thus writes, "The armorial bearings of Guyenne are a leopard. Those of the Celts, especially of the Belgians, are a lion, and those of the French, a frog. The frog represents the marshes whence the French sprung." And again, "The cosmography of Munster has transmitted to us a very remarkable fact of this kind. Macamir, king of the French, having penetrated from Westphalia into Tongres, saw in a dream a figure with three heads, the one of a lion, the other of an eagle, and the third of a frog. He consulted there, it is added, a celebrated druid of the country named Alrunus, who assured him that this figure represented the three powers which had reigned successively over the Gauls, the Celts, whose symbol was the lion, the Romans designated by the eagle, and the Franks by the frog because of their marshes." Third point, in the 6th century, number 46 of the Prophecies of Nostradamus, page 251, translated by Garanciers of London in 1672, occurs the following lines: "By the eagle he meaneth the emperor, and by the frog the king of France, for before he took the fleur de luce, the French bore three frogs." In Pynson's edition of Fabian's Chronicle, at the beginning of the account of Pharamond, the first king of the Franks, who reigned in Treves about AD 420, there is a shield of arms bearing three frogs, page 37 of Ellis' edition, with the words underneath, "This is the old arms of France." The banner underneath, having upon it the three frogs, is from the ancient tapestry in the Cathedral of Reims, representing battle scenes of Clovis, who is said to have been baptized there upon his conversion to Christianity. And the Battle of Clovis, which is illustrated, has on it three frogs. The next engraving is from the Franciscan Church at Innsbruck, where is a roll of tall bronze figures, 23 in number, representing principally the most distinguished personages of the House of Austria, the armour and costumes being those chiefly of the 16th century, and the workmanship is excellent. Among them is Clovis, King of France, and on his shield, three fleurs-de-lis and three frogs, with the words underneath, "Clovis, the first Christian King of France," and an illustration of the armorial shield of Clovis. Point 5. Optanus de Militari Officio, page 155, states that the three frogs were the old arms of France, without specifying what race of kings. 6. Professor Scott supposes the three frogs to have been distinctly the original arms of the Bourbon, Bourb, signifying mud. This may have been the case. When their family became the dynasty of France, they probably assumed the frogs as their arms, being kings of the Franks, whose symbol it had been so long. The Bourbon arose out of the mud, which is natural to frogs, and by the revolution of 1848 are deep in the mud again. Number 7, Tipotius, page 75, gives as the device on a coin of Louis VI, the last French king before Hugh Capet, the first of the Bourbon, a frog with the inscription "Mihi terra lacusque," land and water are mine. 8. In the Encyclopaedia Metropolitana on heraldry, it is stated that Paulus Emilius blazons the arms of France, argent three diadem gules. Others say they bear three toads, sable in a field vert, which if they ever did, it must have been before the existence of the present rules. Such is the testimony I have to offer in the case before us. The conviction produced on my mind is that the frogs in the prophecy are the symbols of the French democratic power. It will be seen from the armorial shield of Clovis that the frogs and the lilies were both used as symbols. They are both indigenous to wet or marshy lands, and therefore very fit emblems of the French, who came originally from the marshes of Westphalia. But on the shield of Pharamond, so far back as AD 420, the frogs without the lilies appear in the armorial bearings of the Franks. And in the medal of Childeric the First, there is no lily, but the frog only. It would therefore seem from this that the lilies were not in the original arms, but superadded many years after, and at length adopted by the Bourbon as the symbol of their race in its dominion over the frogs. These then represent the nation, and the lilies, or fleur-de-lis, the ruling dynasty. Now, if the apostle had said, "I saw three unclean spirits like lilies come out of the mouths," he would have intimated by such similitude that the French Bourbon were the cause of the unclean spirits issuing forth from the Sultan, the Emperor, and the Roman Prophet. But he does not say this. He says they were like frogs. The truth then is obvious. In AD 96, when John was an exile in Patmos, the Franks were savages in an unnamed country, living by hunting and fishing like American Indians. But the Holy Spirit revealed to him that this people would play a conspicuous part in the affairs of nations, and foreseeing by what symbol they would represent themselves, he symbolized their nation by it, and styled them frogs. He informed him that under the sixth vial their influence would be remarkably apparent, that the frog nation would have much to do with the dragon, beast, and false prophet. In fact, that so intimate and direct would be their dealing with them that its effect would be perceived in the warlike tendency and influence of the measures proceeding from the Sultan, the Emperor, and the Pope, who, being so completely entangled in the complications created by the policy of the frog power, would, in their endeavours to extricate themselves, involve the whole habitable in war, which would end in the destruction of the two-horned beast, the false prophet, and the subjugation of the surviving horns to a new imperial dominion for a time. Strong analysis of the 11th and 16th chapters of the Revelation will be found in no other book that I am aware of. It is entirely new, but as I have said before, no interpretation of prophecy in relation to the past or present is worth anything which is not in harmony with facts. My interpretation must be tried by the same rule, and if it will not stand the test, then let it fade away into everlasting forgetfulness. But if it prove to be correct, I have no apprehension that it will be lost. Facts, then, I remark, are in strict accordance with the exposition given, as I shall briefly point out. In the last week of February 1848, the Parisian democracy, ever foremost in revolution, plucked the Bourbon lily from its throne and thrust it deep into its native mud. This dynasty of 1,000 years was abolished, and the nation resumed its original Westphalian right of choosing a ruler better suited to its taste. The fleur-de-lis being thrown aside, the frogs, by a vote of 6 millions, set over themselves the nephew of their democratic emperor, who had done such good service in executing judgment upon their enemies. The president of the French Republic, and here there is a footnote, that is, of course, the Second Republic. In 1852, the president, Louis Napoleon, revived the empire, being proclaimed emperor as Napoleon III, and declaring that the empire is peace. We return to the text. The president of the French Republic is therefore the incarnation of the frog power, as the Bourbon were of the beast, while ruling the tenth of the kingdoms. From February, the outbreaks of the democracy in other countries became frequent and formidable, and the National Assembly and its provisional government constituted, in fact, the parliament and executive of the democracy throughout Europe. Under the shadow of their favour, Germany and Italy became insurgent, and Hungary followed in the wake of insurrection. The earth shook on every side. Urged on by its democracy, Sardinia attacked the beast, and provoked by the treachery of the false prophet, the people of Rome rose and scared him into exile. After this, the plucking up of the Lombard kingdom by the roots and the defeat of the Sardinian horn at Novara, by which the little horn became triumphant in Italy, caused the frogs to seize on Rome, that their interests in the peninsula might be preserved from annihilation. By this move, the frog nation placed itself in antagonism to the two-horned beast and the false prophet. The frogs invite the prophet to return to Rome, in other words, to put himself in their power, for which, with the experience of French hospitality toward his predecessors before his eyes, and the treatment he had already received in Rome, he has not the smallest inclination, notwithstanding all his professions to the contrary. If he were to return, he could not remain there 24 hours in the absence of a strong military force, and the frogs would consent to no other than their own, for they occupied Rome not out of love to the Pope, but as a check upon Austria in Italy. The truth is, Austria and the Pope are natural allies, and are as intimately related as the eyes and mouth of a man are to the man himself. Their fortunes are inseparable. The fate of one is the fate of both, even perdition by the burning flame of war. The army of the frog power has seized upon Rome, and the false prophet will not return because he regards the frogs as his real foes. If the Austrians had possession of the city, he would go back in triumph, but this is not the case, and he is obliged to temporize until the times be more propitious. After this manner, then, the frogs have become an obstacle in the way of Austria and the Pope, who are both desirous of their expulsion from Rome. They have become the occasion of unclean spirits proceeding from the emperor and the Roman prophet, which will yet embroil them all, and in the end accomplish the destruction of the Austro-Papal dominion. In regard to the Sultan, the frogs are seen exerting their influence upon him. They have assured him of their support in case of his being attacked by Russia. This promise is sure to bring on a war between the Porte and the autocrat. And again a footnote notes, it did, in 1853. If the Sultan had been left to himself, being weak, he would have yielded and so have avoided war, but being energized by France and England, two strong military and naval powers, the Sultan feels himself a match for Russia and prepared to assume a bold and warlike attitude. But these assurances will only lure him on to ruin. No powers, however strong, can save dominions foredoomed of God. Their friendship for the Sultan will be as fatal to him as the friendship of England for Austria and the Pope was to them in the days of Napoleon. The autocrat, being God's sword upon Turkey, will be too strong for them both. And a footnote reads, ultimately it will be so, although Russia was checked by the Crimean War. I return to the text. The autocrat, being God's sword upon Turkey, will be too strong for them both, for in the tumult and confusion created by the measures of the Sultan, the Emperor, and the Roman Bishop, their several dominions will be abolished, and the autocrat remain Lord of the Ascendant. If the reader take a survey of Europe, as exhibited in the events of the last 2 years, he will see the view I have presented still further illustrated. The Pope and the Emperor have been the principals who have brought about the wars on the continent. The unclean spirit of the little horn went forth to Russia and brought down its hosts upon Hungary. It is also going forth to Prussia in opposition to the democratic constitution it is developing at Erfurt. And in concert with Russia, it has gone forth to the Sultan, with whom it has interrupted its former amicable relations. Before the Pope consented to be restored by France, an unclean spirit went forth from him likewise, and brought the Austrians, Neapolitans, and Spaniards into his states, when he found the frogs could not be excluded. I pointed these things out to thousands of people in my lectures and told them that in regard to Hungary, they were deceiving themselves if they imagined the Magyars would succeed in their war of independence, that Hungary was a brittle toe kingdom and one of the three horns which were to be plucked up by the roots by the little horn. Meetings of sympathy for the Hungarians were being held throughout England and news arriving every week of Austrian defeats and Magyar victories. Still, I said, if I have fallen upon the true principles of interpretation, it is impossible for the Hungarians to triumph. So certainly incorrect did some regard this view of the matter, that they said, when I returned to London, I should have to expunge what I had advanced about Hungary from the manuscript before I published this book. A preacher who had listened to me at one place was so convinced of my error that in his next discourse he predicted the certain triumph of the brave Hungarians over all their enemies. But alas for him, men should never prophesy of the future from present appearances. Though these were against my exposition, I was persuaded it would turn out in the end as I had said, and I added furthermore that an unclean spirit was to go forth out of the mouth of the dragon as well as from the mouths of the beast and of the false prophet, but that while we would discern the spirits issuing forth from these, we did not yet perceive one issuing from the Sultan. Nevertheless, though then calm and tranquil, we should soon see a warlike disposition manifest itself in his policy growing out of the Hungarian War. The unclean spirit of the Little Horn had brought the Russians into Hungary, which would only whet their appetites for Turkey, whom they would prepare to devour next. In 2 or 3 weeks, after making these statements, which I had said before, were not whispered in a corner, but spoken before thousands, all Europe was astounded by the news of Gorgay's surrender and the ruin of the Magyar cause. The details are known to everyone. As I had said, so it came to pass. Turkish sympathy was with the Hungarians, and hospitality to the refugees was made a casus belli by the autocrat. And on the refusal of the Sultan to violate it, diplomatic relations were broken off between Russia, Austria and Turkey, and the unclean spirit, energized by the frogs, exhibits even the Sultan as a belligerent. The mission, then, of these three demons, for the period which remains of their political existence, is to stir up the nations to war, which will redound to their own confusion. The press is prophesying smooth things, and persuading the world of the moderation of the autocrat, and of the good intentions of Austria and the Pope. It has told us several times that the extradition affair was composed, and that peace between Russia and Turkey will not be interrupted. And, as often, it unsays what it had before affirmed. But the reader need place no reliance upon newspaper speculations. Their scribes know not what God has revealed. Consequently, their reasonings are vain and sure to take a wrong direction. As records of facts, the journals are invaluable. But if a person permit his opinions to be formed by the views presented in the leading articles and the letters of our own correspondents, he will be continually misled and compelled to eat his words forevermore. The Bible is the enlightener. If men would not be carried about by every wind that blows, let them study this. It will unfold to them the future and make them wiser than the world. The coming years will not be years of peace. The policy of the autocrat will be to throw his adversaries off their guard and take the Sultan by surprise. He is to come against him like a whirlwind, with chariots and with horsemen and with many ships, and he will enter into the countries and overflow and pass over, and many countries shall be overthrown. This is the career marked out for him, which neither France nor England nor the world combined can obstruct or circumvent.